Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, thank you so much for hanging on. I would just like to, and I've been gone, but I'd like to thank our guest, Will Franklin, a real warrior, Jason Robb coming on first hour, Paul Fromm, Sister Monica Schaefer, and Kenan, the political prisoner that was on second hour. I thought I knew it was bad, but I never knew. I didn't know Canadian citizens could be treated worse than a pedophile, serial killer, serial murderer, just for questioning areas, specifics of the so-called Holocaust. It's horrible, folks, and I'd just like to put this out there before we go to the bitter ender. It's time that we stop, we think, and we prepare. We start getting ready for things getting worse like they are in Canada and the UK. We always talk about about solutions on Blood River Radio. But just like to leave that with you. But now, people, we're going to go to, I won't say a lighter hour, but this third hour with the bitter ender, the professor, is so vital that we hammer into our, especially our young people, our true history, just how great our Confederate ancestors were. So thank God for Gene, the bitter ender. Bitter ender, what are we going to be talking about tonight, brother?
How you doing, Eddie? Well, I've got a special extra historian here. My brother Don has come up here from Texas.
Wow.
If you hear this voice in the background correcting me going, no, that didn't happen on the 3rd, the 14th of June, Don is going to keep me straightened out here. So we're glad to have him. He's visiting his daughter and grandchildren up in up north in Nashville, and then they're going to be heading back out to Texas next week, but we're sure glad to have him here.
I'm so glad his name is Don. Hello, Don. What a thrill. We love, I tell you what, Gene is the, your brother, he is the pillar of Blood River Radio. Everybody loves him. I've never seen anybody with such a vast knowledge of his expertise, area of expertise. So welcome to Blood River Radio, brother.
Thanks, dude. Appreciate it.
All right. I thought we'd do a little kind of off the track. We wanted to cover today specifically the battles, the 2 day battles in Nashville, Tennessee in 1864, December 15th and 16th. But we're going to back up a little bit and kind of set the stage for how that happened and where we got to those armies just on the field, frozen fields south of Nashville in December of 1864. So we kind of look at the war fought in two main theaters of the war, the Eastern Theater, which was Virginia, Maryland, the Carolinas, and the Western Theater was the land west of the Appalachian Mountains or the Smoky Mountains over to the river, and then across the Mississippi was the Trans-Mississippi Department. So by this time, in 1864, the war in the East had shifted from an offensive war by the Confederates to mainly a defensive war. After the fall of Vicksburg, Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, that we call Useless Grant, but anyway, whatever you call him, he'd been transferred east to take over the Army of the Potomac. And he was basically in command of all the armies, and George Meade, who had fought Lee at Gettysburg, was actually in command of the Army of the Potomac, but Grant was calling all the shots. So it was Grant versus Lee, and in the spring of that year, May of 1864, they opened what they call the Wilderness Campaign. We just fought through an area of Virginia was called the Wilderness, close to where Chancellorsville was. There was a battle at the Wilderness at Spotsylvania, Hanover, and then all the way down. And Lee stopped Grant every one of these, but Grant outnumbered him better than 2-1. So Grant could throw troops at Lee and then take a large portion of his army and swing around to the east and threaten to cut Lee off from Richmond. So Lee may stop Grant or actually win the battle, but he had to keep falling back to protect the Confederate capital at Richmond. So in this Wilderness campaign that they're talking about, the U.S. casualties for the Army of the Potomac were more than Lee had in his entire army.
Damn.
And one of the worst days that they had was down close to Richmond. Eventually, from September of 1864 through April of 1865, it turned into trench warfare. And the trenches were spread along south of Petersburg, up around Richmond. And then with a much larger army, Grant could keep extending the lines, until finally the lines broke and Richmond had to be abandoned. So I've always wondered, though, and I would like to ask Brett Barr on Fox News. He came out with that book about Grant, got all kind of accolades and number one bestseller and all this stuff about that. What would have happened to Grant had he started out in the East versus Lee in 1861, when the Army of Northern Virginia, the Confederate Army, was the premier fighting force in North America at that time? What would we have ever heard about Grant if he had had to face Lee, James Longstreet before he got wounded, First Corps commander, Second Corps commander, Thomas Stonewall Jackson before he died at Chancellorsville, Cavalry Corps commander, Jeb Stuart before he was killed at Yellow Tavern? Would we have ever heard of Grant if he had started out against Lee? Or would he just be a footnote in history like Irwin McDowell or Fighting Joe Hooker or Ambrose P. Burnside or John Pope? But Grant had luck on his side. He started out in the Western theater of the war against the Confederate commanders in 1862. Now, he did get defeated at Belmont, Missouri, and Leonidas Polk, they say in history, was the only Confederate general to actually defeat Grant in a head-to-head confrontation. But then, in February of 62, Grant and Admiral Foote's gunboats start steaming up the Tennessee River to take out the Confederate fort at Fort Henry, which Grant had really nothing to do with. The local people told these pitiful Confederate leadership that we had out here, they wanted to build water batteries down close to the river so they could fire directly into the hull of enemy ships. And the local people would tell them, said, look up in that tree right there. How do you think that driftwood and that brush got up in that tree about 20 feet over your head? When the rains come and the river rises, it's going to be that high. And they said, oh, no, it won't do it. We'll do this, we'll do that. Well, it did. And so Admiral Foote's gunboats sailed right into what was left above water, and it wasn't much, above water at Fort Henry. Grant's troops were disembarked several miles downriver, and they never even got to Fort Henry. They were slopping around through flood water and backwater and creeks and mud. They never even got there. And so the Confederates abandoned Fort Henry, went across the neck of land that was called the land between the rivers, and now it's the state park, land between the lakes, to Fort Donelson. Now, Grant did get slowed down in crossing from the Tennessee River over to Dover and Fort Donelson, the Confederate fort on the Cumberland River. He did get slowed down. There was a lieutenant colonel that nobody had ever heard of back then by the name of Nathan Bedford Forrest, and he harassed Grant's march. They cut trees to fall across the road. They did everything that they could to slow Grant's army before they got to the Confederate fortifications at Fort Donelson. So finally, Grant gets there. He then expects the gunboats to come up and knock off Fort Donelson just like they did at Fort Henry. But the Confederates were firing from an elevated position. Fort Donelson was up on a bluff, and it wasn't about to be flooded out. And when they were firing at these gunboats, they had artillery shells that were dropping down on them rather than straight fire. They tore up the federal gunboats. So then Grant decided that he's going to lay siege to the fort. And, of course, we've covered this before. That's where the Confederates decided to break out. They did. They launched a surprise attack. Once again, Forrest was out there leading the charge. So now they had the road open to go to Clarksville, or they had a second option of throwing everything they had into the attack and driving Grant back over the bluff and into the Cumberland River. And the brilliant West Point commanders decided to turn around, march into the fort, and surrender the next day. The next big battle Grant was in was down at Shiloh in April of 1862. And once again, luck was on his side. The Confederates caught him off guard. They drove him out of their camps. And there was one or two places where they resisted the charge. The idea was to drive the federal army away from their supply base at Pittsburg Landing. And as the battle turned out, it drove them in the opposite direction towards Pittsburgh Landing. And then the Confederate general, Albert Sidney Johnston, got killed by a stray bullet, and the attack kind of lost its momentum. And Grant survived Shiloh. Now, we have to remember also that Grant's first campaign against Vicksburg in the spring of 1863 was an overland campaign from Memphis down through the central heart of Mississippi. But Bedford Forrest and his cavalry cut across the river, took out his supply line, the Mobile and Ohio Railroad, and we'll finish up when we get back from the break.
Can't wait to hear it, Gene. Be right back, folks.
As you are aware, America is divided over every fault line possible. This is intentionally fostered by those who do not love God, family, or country. We believe a peaceful future as a free people absolutely depends on civility. Clarion Call for Civility is looking for funding and volunteers at every level to make our hopes and efforts a reality. Please donate, sign our pledge, and help us in our sacred cause. Please visit callforcivility.com for more details. callforcivility.com.
This is Michael Hill, Chief of the League of the South. I listen to Blood River Radio, and you should too. In fact, you should be telling your friends, your family, and your associates to listen to Eddie Miller and the good folks at Blood River Radio. They stand resolutely for the preservation of white civilization, what we once called Christendom, and they stand against the ongoing campaign of white genocide. In these trying and uncertain times, it's more important than ever to speak and act in defense of our God, our people, and our civilization. Blood River Radio speaks the truth and speaks it boldly. I've been on this show many times as a guest, and I'm very proud of my association with you. May our just cause prevail. Hail victory.
Bypass the mainstream narrative with Liberty News Radio at libertynewsradio.com. Engage with charismatic hosts live or on demand. We cover the crucial news focused on God, family, and country. News that other networks simply refuse to use. Think of LNR as hard-hitting news and podcasts at your fingertips anytime, anywhere. Join us at libertynewsradio.com. Empower your day with the truth, because the truth will set you free. libertynewsradio.com.
Tell you something, boy, if I did give you power, you got nothing. Nobody gives you power. Real power is something you take.
Dear Blood River Radio family, before we go back to Brother Gene, if you will, a few people, especially around Nashville, call the news station there, WTVF-TV News, and ask to speak to Phil Williams. Ask him why he's, for 2 years in a row, he's turned our turned down our invitations to come on to Blood River Radio to debate Gene and me, to ask us the same question he asked those weak-kneed people up there in Montgomery Bell. I guarantee double damn to you he won't do it. He's a poor example of a man. He's a coward. He's a liar. Anyway, with that, back to you, Brother Gene.
Well, that's what we were saying during the break. You know, the communists and that Frankfurt School that came out of Germany over here, they didn't want to fight Western civilization in a conventional warfare. So they came up with a much better plan. Infiltrate the academic institutions, take over the chairman of the history department, the English department, the political science, and then turn out two or three generations of these dumbed down American college students that want to go into education. And they've indoctrinated him, all of them, with this communist garbage. And look, they got a commie mayor of New York, so it's working. And they want to control the news media, which they do. And so they've got control of everything. Why do they have to debate it when they can put out their lies and propaganda every night at 6 p.m. on the local news? So they're not going to debate because they know they'll lose. So anyway, that's modern history right there. Well, we were talking about the differences in Ulysses S. Grant as commander of the Union Army and Lee, Robert E. Lee as commander of the Army of Northern Virginia. And the question I always had from the first segment, I would like to ask Brett Baer if what did he think would happen if Grant had started out early in the war against Lee in Virginia versus some of the incompetent commanders that the poor old Army of Tennessee was stuck with in the early part of the war out here in the Western Theater. So that's what the situation was in the summer of 1864. We're going to fast forward a little bit and pick up the action in June and July of 1864. John Bell Hood was put in command of the Confederate Army of Tennessee, defending the vital railroad and supply and warehouse facilities at Atlanta, Georgia. And William Sherman was commanding the Union Army that fought all the way down the Western and Atlantic Railroad from Dalton, Georgia, and now they were surrounding Atlanta. And they put Hood, President Davis, put Hood in charge of the Confederate Army because he wanted somebody that had a reputation for action and attack. And Hood lived up to his reputation. Peachtree Creek, Ezra Church, and the Battle of Atlanta itself, three major battles around Atlanta. And they stunned Sherman's army, drove them back off parts of the field, but they could not. They, once again, they were fighting an army that was twice their size. And they may win a victory or partial victory, but they couldn't finish them off. And so eventually, just like at Petersburg, Sherman got enough of his army around Atlanta and after the fall of Jonesboro that he was about to trap Hood in Atlanta and take out a major Confederate army. Hood pulled the army out. They turned over Atlanta to Sherman, who burned the city, then headed out for his march from Atlanta to the sea. In about an 80-mile-wide swath across Georgia and the Carolinas, robbing people, stealing their food, burning their homes. And this was their version of total warfare on civilian population. You have to be really brave to attack civilians that are unarmed. Oh, yeah. So Forrest then, Hood then, decided that he couldn't catch up to Sherman. He decided to turn north and bring the Army of Tennessee back home into Tennessee and possibly capture the city of Nashville. And he was coming up through Alabama, going to cross the Tennessee River at Florence, and he needed cavalry out in front of him. And Bedford Forrest cavalry had been over on the west bank of the Tennessee River, and we'd talked about this, where he destroyed the supply depot at Johnsonville. So he got Forrest cavalry from West Tennessee around the Tennessee River, crossed the river at Florence, and was thrown out in front of Hood's army to fan out in front of him. Forrest cavalry fought against James Wilson's U.S. cavalry from the time they crossed the Tennessee River on November 17th until the opening shots were fired in the Battle of Franklin on November the 30th in 1864. Forrest's men never lost one of the engagements they fought with the U.S. cavalry. They drove them all the way from almost the Tennessee border back up to Franklin, Tennessee, which is about 70 miles. And then Forrest was ready to continue the assault during the Battle of Franklin on November 30th. Now, we talked about the Confederate disasters at Spring Hill on November 29th, where Hood was not there on the field of battle to take command of the army on the field, and they allowed an entire U.S. Army Corps under John Schofield to literally tiptoe past them that night on the Columbia Pike. And Hood woke up the next morning and think there was going to be they were going to fight the Battle of Spring Hill. There was nobody there left to fight. They'd all gone. So Forrest cavalry was then put on the trail after him and chased him up and over Winstead Hill and into the earthworks around Franklin. We talked about that. These earthworks had been built 2 years ago, and the Federal Army had all day now to dig out the trenches even deeper and tear down the buildings around Franklin for boards to shore up the fortifications that went from the Harpeth River on the east side of Franklin in a semicircle all the way around the Harpeth River on the south side of Franklin. Hood's officers advised him not to attack against 2 miles of open ground. They had a conference at 1 o'clock that afternoon, just back over the hill south of Franklin at a place called the Harrison House, which is still there today. It's a private residence, but you can drive by on the Columbia Pike, and there's a sign there and tells you about what happened before the prior to the Battle of Franklin. So the officers in the Army of Tennessee were advising Hood not to attack across 2 miles of open ground against a fortified position. And Forrest even offered to use his cavalry to get across the Harpeth River with one division of infantry with their artillery, swing around behind the Federal Army, and take up a position at a place called Hollow Tree Gap, about 10 or 12 miles north of Franklin. He said, we put the infantry in the gap, we put the cavalry on the flanks, and his quote was, this time we'll put the cork in the bottle. And Hood wouldn't listen to him. And Forrest knew that territory. He had operated there in 1863, so he knew all the roads around Franklin, the little paths and hog trails and whatever you want, to get around that area. None of the other Confederate officers, including Hood, or none of the corps commanders, the division commanders in the Confederate Army, had been there. But Forrest was the only one that knew the territory and knew how to get around. They wouldn't listen to him. Hood was determined to make this frontal assault, which took place late on the afternoon of Franklin, November 30th, and it was a total disaster. The Army of Tennessee was just absolutely slaughtered trying to get across these earthworks. The battle went on from about 5 o'clock in the afternoon till 9:30 at night. So most of the fighting, you know, it gets dark by 5 o'clock in November. So most of the fighting was in the dark. And once the initial Confederate breakthrough was driven back across the Federal lines, they didn't come all the way back out 2 miles to Winstead Hill. They just fell back into the darkness. So they would hear firing and see flashes of rifles somewhere 100 yards away, and they said, well, maybe they're breaking through. So here they'd go again, launch another attack. And then they'd hear it way down to the right, and they'd say, well, all right, we'll throw our weight in there. And by 9:30, the Federal Army had torn down enough buildings to lay planks across the railroad bridge to get out of Franklin, because horses aren't going to walk over something they can see through. That's like a cattle gate. 9:30, they took off to Nashville. And, of course, the sun came up the next morning, and Hood and the Confederates saw the slaughter of all the bodies laying out across those fields south of the earthworks. So now we get into the Battle of Nashville. On December 2nd, Hood, well, before that, his officers told him, said, we don't want to go to Nashville. That's a bad move. That city fell to the Federals after the fall of Fort Donelson on the Cumberland River. And of course, Nashville's on the Cumberland. And they had fortified that position since February of 1862, and now here we are in 1864. There were a series of forts built around the south side of Nashville, and it was basically the same layout as it was at Franklin. The forts went from the Cumberland River on the east side of Nashville, swung around south of Nashville, and were tied into the Cumberland River on the west side of Nashville. So with an army three or four times the size of Hood's, it would have been a nearly impossible situation to attack. So his officers told him, we don't want to try to take a 20-mile fort like that. He said, why don't we fall back to the Duck River and draw George Thomas, who is now the Union commander that had been sent back by Sherman. He was the Union commander in Nashville. Why don't we fall back, draw Thomas out of the city, defeat him out in the open where he has no chance of getting back into these forts, and then go after Nashville? Well, Hood wouldn't go by that. So his plan was to lay siege to the south of the city and draw Thomas out and defeat him and follow the retreat of the Federal Army back into Nashville and liberate Nashville from the Federal Army. So that was his plan, but the numbers really didn't stack up in favor of the Confederate Army. After the losses at Franklin, the Army of Tennessee was down to about 30,000 effective soldiers. Thomas was bringing in troops from St. Louis and Chicago and Louisville, all over the Midwest, to create this army in Nashville. And so by the time the battle started on Thursday, December the 15th, the Confederates had about 30,000 on the field. The Federal Army under Thomas had about 50,000. And they were fortified in a position that absolutely could not be taken unless they had, you know, modern heavy armor and tanks and something like that, like they would have today. We will wind us up the next two segments with the Battles of Nashville on December 15th and 16th.
Be back, folks, in just a minute.
Hey. How would you like to help this program reach more people and earn silver at the same time? Call or text 801-669-2211 for complete details.
News this hour from Town Hall. I'm Mary Rose. Police say multiple people have been shot in the area of Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. The school has issued an active shooter alert and urged students and staff to take shelter today, the second day of final exams. Police did not immediately release details about the victim's conditions or the circumstances of the shooting. The reported shooting occurred near the Barris and Holly building, a seven-story complex that houses the university School of Engineering and Physics Department. Students were urged to shelter in place as police responded and people were told to avoid the area. Officials cautioned that information remained preliminary as investigators worked to determine what had occurred. Days of torrential rain are causing unprecedented river flooding and pressures on levees in Washington State. Jennifer King has the story.
What's described as an atmospheric river is causing historic flooding in Washington state, stranding families, washing over roads and bridges, and cutting off a border crossing to Canada.
This is something that the people of the state of Washington have not faced before, this level of flooding.
Washington Governor Bob Ferguson spoke at a news conference in Tukwila Friday afternoon.
The situation is extremely unpredictable.
The governor says he's grateful to President Trump, who has signed an emergency declaration. I'm Jennifer King.
Floodwaters are receding across western Washington today, easing pressures on levees and allowing cleanup to begin in Sagatt Valley. Officials warn rivers remain high and more rain is expected later this weekend. Getting trapped in quicksand is really something you normally see on an old TV show, but it really happened this week at Utah's Arches National Park.
When you hear something that only happens, you know, essentially every 10 or 15 years, it kind of makes you scratch your head and say, huh, is this what I heard? And sure enough, that's exactly what you heard.
Emergency responder John Marshall. More details, townhall.com.
I'm Andrew Del Rey.
And I'm Todd Avakian, and we're with Union Home Mortgage.
Like so many of you, Todd and I are still heartbroken over the loss of our dear friend, Charlie Kirk.
Charlie wasn't just a client. He was a friend. We helped him and Erica with their home loans. But more than that, we shared faith, trust, and a love for this country.
We've had the privilege of helping many in this audience, too. Families working hard to build something lasting. And we want to keep doing that, helping you find stability, lower debt, and realize the dream of home ownership.
Ready to own a home? Now's the time. Buyers finally have more inventory, better negotiating power, and less competition. But that window won't stay open long.
Get pre-approved today with Union Home Mortgage. Go to andrewandtodd.com or call 888-888-1172. That's andrewandtodd.com. andrewandtodd.com.
We were proud to serve Charlie and Hugh and many others in the Salem family, and we'd be honored to help you too.
Visit us at andrewandtodd.com or call us at 888-888-1172.
I'm Pastor Everett Ramsey, pastor of Faith Baptist Church, a congregation of God's covenant people. Informed Christians know that we are at the brink of a long-planned one-world government being executed that will not tolerate true Christian faith. There is a way to stop it. Our church has used God's spiritual weapons of warfare many times over the years, and in every case that was properly executed, the Church of Jesus Christ has been delivered. It is called the Court of Divine Justice. David used it many times. Read Psalm 37, Psalm 109. It includes truthful information, repentance, and imprecatory prayers. Blood River Radio is the only radio station I know that supports action based on truth about lies concerning the Confederacy, the Civil Rights Movement, the German people, the true Holocaust, and who the true covenant people of God are, and the sins and failures of the churches, if any of these, this means anything to you, and it should, then please say so with your money, as well as prayers. You may obtain information from us about the Courts of Divine Justice by sending your offering and request to Blood River Radio, and we take none of the money.
Introducing Managed IT Services from NPI. We offer top-notch data backup and recovery, email spam protection, and network security tailored to your needs and budget. With 20-plus years of experience in the medical field, our HIPAA-certified consultants know what it takes to protect sensitive information. Don't settle for less. Give us a call at 801-706-6980 and experience the difference with Managed IT Services. Remember, your IT support should be fast, efficient, and reliable.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. It smells like victory.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Ooh, they're red, white, and blue.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I'd like a quick announcement. Sister Maka just called during the break. And the fellow we had on the first hour, Kennan, who the Canadian government pretty much looks like they're trying to starve him to death. He can't have a, not allowed to have a telephone. He's not to have can't have a computer, can't go to the internet. He can't make a living. So, if you will, anyone that would like to help this man, send me an email, eddie@bloodriverradio.com, and I'll get you the information how you can contribute to him. And later on, when I'm absolutely positively sure that we have the exact give some go thing, we'll make the announcement again next week. So if you will, just repeat, send me an email, eddie@bloodriverradio.com, if you'd like to help out this this valiant warrior who's still fighting against all odds. So thank you so much, people. Go ahead, Bitter Ender. Continue on, buddy. You were doing really good, buddy.
Well, that's a shame. I've got several really good friends in Canada, and they don't have much anything very good to say about the Liberal government in Ottawa.
It's
terrible that the communists have taken over a beautiful country and great individual peoples, people in Canada, and just the nicest bunch of people you'd ever want to meet in your life. But, you know, the cities vote the government in, and Toronto and Ottawa and all of these big cities vote in these Liberal communist wackos, and then the rest of the people vote, but their vote doesn't count. Then they have to live under this, and I really feel sorry for our friends in Sudbury and Toronto and out in Alberta and what they're having to go through. And they don't like it at all, but they don't have the votes to throw these communist crazy wackos out of office.
And, you know, Gene, it's bad as anything we've heard in the Soviet Union that we've been back, and, you know, you and I came up during the Cold War, when the old evil Russians and stuff, but it as bad as they were, as we Canada, it's as bad, if not worse. And they say UK is even worse than that. So I never thought in our lifetime it would get that bad, but we'll try to help that fellow as much as we can. But sooner or later, we're going to have to fix it. Sooner or later, and everybody knows what I'm talking about. But anyway, I won't interrupt you anymore, Gene.
That's fine. I think that's very important, Eddie, to get that information out there. And, you know, we think of Canada's the Maple Leaf and the hockey teams and all the things like that. But, you know, it sounds like it would be a horrible place to live, because if you just spoke your opinion, the government's going to swoop down on you and just destroy your life for you. So, anyway, I feel sorry for our friends up there in Canada. Really,
you can't
really
even question anything. You can't even ask. You can't even point out an oddity about the so-called Holocaust, like they said. The fellow pointed out. He said, "Well, this gas chamber is supposed to have was just a wooden door. The cracks under the door. Wouldn't the gas run out and kill the guards?
That would kill the guards.
That's what he went to prison for. Just saying that." But anyway, you're right. It's if we don't do, I think the only thing saving us here, Gene, is our guns. I said I don't know how many of us people have the will to use them. But anyway, I'll shut up and go back to you, Bitter Ender.
Okay, well, since the Battle of Nashville was fought on December 15th and 16th, coming up this next week, we were talking about the campaigns in the East and in the West that led up to this 2-day battle just south of the city of Nashville. So the Confederate Army, after the horrible slaughter that they endured at Franklin, and that was a real morale booster. The next morning, the sun came up, and Hood marched the army right over the battlefield, headed up the Columbia Pike and Franklin Pike up to Nashville. And to walk past those pools of blood and those stacks of bodies that were piled up against the federal earthworks, and to see what happened to your friends and your fellow soldiers the night before, That is not what was called a real morale booster that morning on December the 1st. So by the December 2nd, the Confederate Army has taken up positions on the hills south of Nashville, start digging in, and they think they're going to draw Thomas out of Nashville, defeat him, and then follow the Federals back into Nashville and liberate Nashville from the Yankee Army, which had been under federal control for 2 years. And it had been a brutal, brutal occupation of what they had done. They built forts around the south side of Nashville because they assumed, you know, the Confederates going to try to retake the city from the south. But in each one of those forts, they had this heavy artillery trained down off these hills into the city of Nashville. And the threat was, if we have any kind of insurrection or uprising by the people of Nashville, we will blast your city right off the bluff and into the Cumberland River. And that's why these forts and these Yankee entrenchments around Nashville, well, were so hated by the civilians during the war and especially after the war. And there were several of these big forts, but they were all connected by trenches and earthworks and bomb proofs and things like that. So, you know, like we said, if Hood and I had an army three times this size, the outcome would be very questionable. So the Confederates get there. They start digging in. The Confederate Army under John Bell Hood is starving. They were taking sawdust and mixing it with cornmeal for the soldiers to eat. That's how desperate they were for rations. About a third of the army was without shoes. They'd been marching from Georgia across Alabama up through Tennessee during rain and mud and cold weather. Shoes had just worn out. And about a third of them, now it was freezing temperatures, so they're without shoes. They're trying to tear up blankets or cloth or something to wrap around their feet to try to protect their feet. And then it gets even worse. There's an ice storm that hit Nashville around the 8th of December. The ground was so frozen that horses couldn't even stand up on it. It was that bad. And here are these Confederate soldiers trying to dig holes in the ground to hunker down in the holes and put limbs over them at night and try to protect them from the weather, while the Union Army has all of these barracks and earthworks and things that they didn't care how cold it got. And the Union officers had hotel rooms in all the hotels in Nashville. They didn't care what was going on outside. They were living, you know, 5-star hotels. And so that was what the Confederates were facing right then. Now, they did have some success. Major D.C. Kelly and artillery had placed it along the Cumberland River on the west side of Nashville, the west side of the Confederate works. And so from December the 2nd until the first shots were fired on December the 15th, they shut down the river transports coming into Nashville. There were 19 separate engagements fought on the Cumberland River west of Nashville during that time. And they even sent a gunboat to try to chase them off, and the Confederate artillery battered, it was the Neosia, and they battered that thing all to pieces. And so but it didn't matter. You know, the Federals had the railroad supply lines between Nashville and Louisville, and then coming across from West Tennessee. So they were well supplied. Nothing was going to bother them. So Hood and his, well, we go back to Franklin, and we were talking about Franklin defeating Wilson coming up to Franklin, and that's one more point I want to make, and look at the poor decisions that were made. So Bedford Forrest had three divisions of cavalry in his cavalry corps. When he got to Franklin, Hood makes this brilliant decision to split his cavalry up and put two divisions over on the east to try to fight their way across the Harper River, and left one, James Chalmers' cavalry division, way out to the west, where basically they did nothing during the Battle of Franklin. So Forrest got across the Harper River and got into fights with Wilson's cavalry back and forth across the river with only two divisions. So what would have happened at the Battle of Franklin if Forrest had all three of his divisions? So we fast forward here up to Nashville, and Hood's best commander on the field, Bedford Forrest, he sends him away from Nashville to go over to Murfreesboro and try to attack the giant federal supply depot at Fort Rosecrans in Murfreesboro. So probably his best officer on the field was not there for the two-day battle of Nashville. And how would it have turned out if all of Forrest's cavalry corps had been there on the field? So once again, the Confederates the northern newspapers showed a diagram of the Confederate Army all the way from the Harpeth River on the east, I mean the Cumberland River on the east, all the way around Nashville to the Cumberland River on the west. That wasn't the case. Hood only had enough men to go about halfway around there. So his whole left or western flank was left open. They had some cavalry under James Chalmers scattered from the Confederate lines about 10 miles. They were covering a 10-mile stretch from the end of the Confederate lines on the western end of their line all the way over to the Cumberland River. And James Wilson had his cavalry reinforced. They got fresh horses. They even took the horses from a circus that was in Nashville. And the federal soldiers came in, took all their horses from the circus to use them to remount Wilson's cavalry. Because Thomas had planned to swing like a giant arc through western Nashville, where the Confederates were so weak, and then hit Hood's lines from a flanking position coming from west to east. But, like I said, Major Kelly, D.C. Kelly, who was one of Forrest's officers, held on to that post on the river up until the first shots were fired on December 15th. So we had this horrible ice storm that came in. The Confederates were freezing in holes that they'd dug in the ground, pulling tree limbs over them. That was all the protection they had. We'll wind up the battle after our break.
You're doing a great job, Tim. I'm enjoying this, and I know our listeners are too.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at cspoa.org. That's cspoa.org.
I'm Monica Schaefer from Canada, a former political prisoner. Here at Blood River Radio, we are not afraid to tell the truth and shame the devil. Our mission is to fight against white genocide. We do that by exposing the lies. We talk about the American Civil War. We talk about the vilification of German people and, by extension, all white people. And we even talk about that linchpin lie, the Holocaust. Deception by the alien enemy within has brought us whites to our knees. My last words at the Schaefer's speech crime trial in Germany were, quote, "If there was a law forbidding us to breathe, we would break that law immediately just to live. And so it is with this law. We must break this law in order to survive and thrive as a people," unquote. Please donate to Blood River Radio and help keep us on the air.
Get ready to be part of something incredible. We're breaking barriers and delivering the powerful stories that mainstream media won't touch. Your support is what fuels our mission to revolutionize journalism and bring you the truth. Join our passionate community of changemakers by donating at libertynewsradio.com today. Together, we're creating the future of news.
Hello, dear Blood River Radio family. This is just a wonderful hour right here. I would say some of it's depressing, but, you know, about what happened, how General Hood kind of wrecked our army of Tennessee. But we have to know these things. We really do. And I got to shut my mouth and go back to the bitter ender who's doing such a fabulous job. I don't know of anybody else in the world who has that kind of expertise, that kind of a memory, that kind of a knowledge. So go ahead, bitter ender.
Well, you're correct, Eddie. It is depressing to see our attempt at Southern independence squandered by so many inept commanders and a government that couldn't fight the type of warfare, the conventional warfare that they wanted to fight. And when you had people like Forrest and Joe Shelby and John Hunt Morgan and John Mosby that knew how to fight the war and bring a larger army to their knees and were ignored. And there was a solution to this problem. It wasn't that the Federal Army was using atomic bombs or something on the South. They were defeated by these people that knew the South could not fight a conventional warfare. We couldn't swap a man for man. We didn't have the numbers to match up to that. We could win, but we could never replace our losses. So anyway, that's the situation we were in Nashville with Hood and his army on the frozen hills south of Nashville. Now, the people in Washington were telling Thomas, you need to attack Hood. You need to attack Hood. Keep him away from Nashville. They thought this was going to continue the war, and maybe the Democrats in the U.S. Congress would have enough strength to pressure Lincoln into signing some kind of peace agreement. He was never going to do that. He didn't care how many people died. His sons weren't going to be in it. But there was a lot of anti-war opposition in the North. So Lincoln and Grant and all the powers in D.C. were burning up the telegraph lines, telling Thomas to attack Hood, drive him away. Then that ice storm came. It got so bad for Thomas, George Thomas, that Grant sent another commander, General John Logan, was on a train from Cincinnati down through Louisville to Nashville to relieve Thomas of his command and put John Logan in command of the Federal Army at Nashville. And he didn't get there till the night of December 15th after the first day's battle had started. And Thomas' attack had driven Hood back about 12 miles south of Nashville. And he said, oh, well, I guess we'll leave you there since you won the first day's battle. So, you know, that's how nervous they were about this Confederate Army. So foggy, cold morning, Thursday, December the 15th, Thomas launches his attack. There was a diversionary attack at the right or eastern end of the Confederate lines to hold them down so they couldn't reinforce the western end. And General Stedman was a Union Corps commander that came out there. His troops were black troops, the USCT, United States Colored Troops. And the thing was, in the Federal Army, all the commands were segregated. They would not integrate the Army. They had totally black units and totally white units. And usually what happened was officers didn't want to command black units. So the officers that were real bust outs and incompetent, they got shuffled off onto the black troops. And that's what happened on that Thursday morning. They tried to go through a railroad cut, and they thought they were going to just march in behind the Confederates. Well, they weren't playing with the Boy Scouts. These were four-year veterans, and they saw what the Stedman and his black troops were trying to do. They did an about-face and got up above this railroad cut, and when the black troops came marching through that railroad cut, they opened fire on them, just mowing them down from on top of the railroad cut, and like shooting fish in a barrel. There were over 800 bodies along that railroad, and the attack, of course, was called off. Over on the other side of Nashville, on the western side, it went a lot better for the Yankees. James Wilson's cavalry came out. Now, they're armed with repeating rifles. The Confederates, all single-shot rifles. So they had a tremendous advantage in firepower. And two Army Corps were on the inside of Wilson's cavalry. So it was like a giant gate swinging through West Nashville. Wilson's cavalry was out on the end of the gate, and then going back to the post or the hub, you had two more Army Corps coming out there. Confederates had a few improvised forts built along what they call the Hillsborough Pike, but that's all that protected their western flank. And General Chalmers' cavalry was, of course, driven right out of the way, like they weren't even there. And then as they hit these forts, they were called Redoubt number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. They started down at the south end on Hillsborough Pike, took 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then the rest of the Confederate line just fell like dominoes. And by that night, the Confederates were in retreat, and the officers under Hood's command were urging him to get away from Nashville, fall back to that line along the Duck River. We can get resupplied. Hopefully we can get uniforms and shoes for the troops. Hood decided, nope, we're going to fight a second battle. So he, during the night, they draw up their lines about 12 miles south of where the old ones were, but much shorter because now they'd lost so many troops. And so when the sun and the fog again came up on Friday, December 16th, Federal Army thought Hood was gone. And all of a sudden they go out and send patrols out, and they run into the Confederate lines. And now they've got to reorganize their army to fight another day's battle. And so it's basically the same thing. The Confederates took a heavy position on their right or eastern flank on Peach Orchard Hill, and then another heavy position on their left on a place called Shy's Hill in Nashville today. And so it took them the Federals a long time to get their artillery in place. They opened up the battle just like they did the day before on the Confederate right or eastern flank. And it was Stedman again that sent the black troops in there. And once again, they came up with the dumbest attack plan possible. Instead of attacking straight into the Confederate lines, they launched an attack that went across the Federal lines. So it's like, a shooting gallery at the state fair and just mowing down the targets that come in front of you. So that Peach Orchard Hill, where I went to high school and where I coached at Franklin Road Academy on top of that hill, they said after that morning attack and artillery barrage and everything they threw at them, that you could walk from the top of that hill all the way down to the foot of the hill where the Interstate Highway 65 is today, and you would never step on the ground. There were that many Federal bodies. But then, once again, out to the west, the attacks against Shy's Hill, the Confederates made a mistake. They were digging in on Shy's Hill that night, and they put their trenches too close to the top of the hill. They had them too close to the topographical crest of the hill. And when you're digging in, you go move down to the military crest of the hill. Yeah. Because if you're on the topographical crest, the enemy can come up almost to you, and you can't shoot them. Because then you'd have to stand up. So you move your lines down 10 or 15 yards down the hill, then you got a clear field of fire. Well, the Confederates were doing it at night. They didn't know they'd made that mistake till the sun came up the next morning. Then it was too late. They couldn't get out of their trenches because Federal artillery and rifle fire would have mowed them down. So late that afternoon, cold rain is falling. Once again, the Federal cavalry gets behind the Confederate lines, and the infantry comes up, sweeps over Shy's Hill, and the Confederate line breaks and starts retreating. The reason it's called Shy's Hill, Colonel William Shy was command of the 20th Tennessee Infantry on that hill. He was, of course, captured. There are reports down through history, and of course the Yankees deny it, that he was an unarmed prisoner of war. They shot him, and what they do know is they stripped his body and bayoneted him to a tree. And then down at the foot of Shy's Hill along Granny White Pike, if you're familiar with Nashville, General Thomas Benton Smith was also captured. He was being escorted to the rear as a prisoner of war. A drunk Yankee officer comes up, slashes him three times across his head with his saber, and leaves his brain exposed. Mm-hmm. And he survived that, but he was in and out of mental institutions the rest of his life in Nashville. So the line breaks. The retreat starts from west to east, and Stephen D. Lee, who was the corps commander there at Peach Orchard Hill, they thought they'd won. I mean, they had defeated everything they'd thrown at them that day, and yet he sees all these figures running across the fields to his left rear. He's afraid the Yankees have come in behind him, and all of a sudden he realizes, no, that's the Confederates. So he pulls his troops out. They form a barricade across Franklin Road to allow the troops to escape. Meanwhile, over in Murfreesboro, Forrest hears that Hood is lost on the 15th. So he withdraws from Murfreesboro, brings his cavalry divisions across country, and catches up with the Confederates back down at Columbia, Tennessee. So now Hood, who didn't want to listen to Forrest because he was not a West Pointer, how did he know anything? Now he's got to depend on Forrest to save his rear end and the rest of the army. So he puts Forrest in charge of the rear guard. So from December, I think it was about the 18th when he caught up with the army, all until Christmas Day, the 25th, when Hood's army finally got across the Tennessee River. Forrest fought battles almost on a daily basis, protecting the wagon train and the rear of the Army of Tennessee when it was retreating. And it was one of the most brutal military campaigns in history. The cold weather hit again. Sam Watkins in that book, Company H, talks about how bad it was. They said you could follow the trail of Hood's army by the bloody footprints in the snow. These boys were without shoes. He said it would rain and freeze. Their hair and their beards were frozen. Their clothes were soaked. And then at night, their clothes would freeze to their bodies. There was no chance to light fires. They were moving. Forrest had enough sense to know. He took the empty wagons, put the barefoot soldiers in that, and saved the army, got them back down to the Tennessee River, and ended that campaign.
I don't see how any of them survived, Gene. But Gene, you did one hell of a job, brother.
Through something like that.
My God, I could never do that. I mean, those people were so incredibly tough. Anyway, we run completely out of time. And I'll tell you what, you did a marvelous job tonight, Bitter Ender, and I can't wait to have you back again. I know our listeners can't either, so thank you very much, Jim.
Brother Don said he's glad to listen to you. You got a great program.
Well, thank you, Brother Don. Thank you. Well, maybe you can come on with Gene next time. Well, you'll probably be back home, but you can call in sometime. Well, thank you so much, Bitter Ender. Thank you much, Don. Thank you much, Blood River Radio family, and thank you much, this visit. Good night, everybody.